Spies. A prison camp near Boston, Timeline 3, January 2004. I think it's quite simple. To use an analogy from U.S. history in my timeline, imagine this is Cape Canaveral, and we're their captured Nazi rocket scientists, Miriam Beckstein told her audience. It was hot inside the crowded wooden hut, which was a small mercy. There was little enough fuel this winter, in the wake of the revolution that had brought down the British imperial crown in the Americas. But the privileged detainees in this hut had a stove and a supply of good Appalachian coal, droplets of water condensed on the inside of the windows, forming slug trails rather than freezing to the glass.
That's an ambitious proposal. Helmut von Rindt was doubtful.
A chunky fellow, formerly part of the Klan's security organization, he was efficient if given a goal, but he wasn't the most imaginative of leaders.
It seems to me we've got more immediate problems.
He raised a bushy eyebrow and looked round at everyone, the dozen or so members of the surviving Klan leadership who'd made it this far.
Like being imprisoned, and our families being held hostage, just to start with.
After a rogue Klan faction had bombed the White House and Capitol, the U.S. nuclear counterstrike had utterly destroyed their home country, the Grünmarkt, in Timeline 1. The survivors had sought exile here, in Timeline 3, but the situation had been complicated, to say the least, by the recent revolution. Helmut continued, giving voice to the complaints Miriam had heard only whispered quietly so far.
This isn't our home. In this new timeline, we have no power and no future unless we take action.
Helmut stood as he spoke, emphasizing words with gestures, fist striking palm in vehement emphasis.
Nor are the radical rabble well disposed toward our kind. We should do better to seek exile in the French Empire and re-establish our trade on the other side of the Atlantic.
By trade, he meant paperwork-free shipping. The Klan had become phenomenally rich by smuggling narcotics into the United States via their home timeline. Miriam suppressed a shudder. She'd been given a leather trench coat by their captors, a gesture of privilege for the leader of the Klan refugees. Worn over a cable-knit sweater and heavy wool skirt, it was at least right for the climate. Now she pulled it tight around her shoulders, as if against a sudden draft. The old trade, smuggling, was how the Klan had gotten into trouble in the first place, and if Helmut thought restarting the trade was a good idea, so must a whole lot of other relatives.
We can't go back. She shook her head, denial personified. They'll be on the lookout for us everywhere in Timeline 2. Everybody knows about us, thanks to those idiots. Trying to restart the traditional smuggling trade in Europe or China is a non-starter. Also, she added, almost as an afterthought, the American government will come after us if they see signs of suspicious activity.
Helmut wasn't dropping it. Look out there, he said, angrily gesturing at the iced over window. This is where they've put us.
Beyond the window, rows of snow-capped barracks huddled together in chilly solidarity within high brick walls topped with broken bottles, set in hastily applied mortar. Guards with bolt-action rifles patrolled beyond the wall. These were the special prisoner quarters, given over to the world walkers, asylum seekers from a parallel universe where history had taken a different course.
It's insupportable. I know you sought alliance with the revolutionaries, but they treat us like... Stop your foolishness!
Iris Beckstein erupted. She looked older than her 60 years, and she was slowly dying. Hunched inside the hood of the half-broken invalid chair their captors had donated, she shuddered briefly, then glared at von Rindt
with a death stare she'd clearly inherited from her mother, the Dowager Duchess.
"Pursuing the old trade is what put us in this camp, in case you've forgotten. And we're not doing badly compared to the neighbors."
The rest of the camp was full of politicals, captured royalist troops, and members of the aristocracy who hadn't made it onto the refugee ships in time to escape the revolution that had toppled the British Empire in early 2003. After the Civil War, the politicals didn't rate heating and full bellies in the famine-struck winter of the emergency. Almost 2 feet of snow lay on the ground outside the huts. Prisoners working under guard removed the frozen bodies from the political side of the camp every morning. The clan refugees, in contrast, had fuel for their stoves and food for their children.
"It can't be worse than for once in your life. Just shut up and listen," Iris grumbled, then subsided in a fit of coughing.
"Mom, are you all right?" Miriam asked anxiously. Iris waved away the offer of help.
"I'm surviving," she said hoarsely. "Been better. Carry on."
Helmut, possibly due to some residual respect for authority, was momentarily silent. Miriam took advantage to continue her urgent pitch. "Helmut is absolutely right that we've got no power or influence here, but I think we can remedy that. Our new goal must be to make ourselves indispensable, and the easiest way to do that is to give them information. We can give them technological and industrial know-how. Knowledge this timeline won't discover themselves for many decades."
"Are you suggesting industrial espionage as a business model?" asked Hugh.
Gangly and inquisitive, he was one of Miriam's most reliable allies within the clan. She could count on him for an easy prompt. The downside, though, was that if the majority didn't feel that their concerns were being adequately addressed by her plan, more and more of them would sign on with Helmut and drift back to their old ways. Before the exile, the clan's members had been held together by fear and a ruthless internal police organization. Now that the worst had happened, Miriam really had no way of compelling them to follow her.
"This goes a lot further than industrial espionage," she said gratefully. "We aren't going to feed them isolated tidbits. We're going to promise a whole new way of life. What we need to do here is what I tried and failed to do in the Grunmarkt. Accelerate social development for all."
The Grunmarkt, one of the eastern kingdoms of North America in Timeline 1, had barely medieval levels of technology. The privileged few with clan connections had been able to import U.S. tech by means of world-walking and had rejected attempts at modernization for the masses. Here in the Commonwealth, they've just conveniently smashed their aristocracy. There's nobody with entrenched privilege to defend. That's an opportunity for us to exploit, if we're smart enough.
"Just how are you going to go about that?" Helmut asked acidly, from inside the prison camp.
Miriam reined in her annoyance. She responded badly to provocative sarcasm. "We need to somehow get the Commonwealth leadership to commit to full-scale industrial development and modernization. Right now, the USA is about 60 years ahead of anyone in this timeline, but I think the Commonwealth can close the gap completely in less than 40 years, maybe 30, with our help. And if they can do that before the USA discovers us here, we'll be infinitely safer. Make no mistake, sooner or later they will find us. And even though we didn't kill their president, they'll expect us to pay the price."
"Is it even possible for a society to progress that rapidly?" asked Brilliana, who was usually loath to disagree with her leader. She perched on a desk in the corner of the room, keeping one wary eye on the door. As Miriam's first sworn bodyguard, she took Miriam's security personally.
"It's 2003. Let's say the USA have a 60-year lead now. In 30 years, it'll be 2033.
You're talking about catching up to a 90-year lead in 30 years, not a 60-year lead. Are you sure about your projections?
Yes. That's why I said it might take nearer to 40.
Miriam's shoulders slumped slightly. A 40-year plan. That was a lifetime's work. A daunting project for anyone.
But it's not impossible. Look at the Korean Peninsula in Timeline 2. North Korea and South Korea started out level pegging in 1953.
They were both oppressive dictatorships with flattened cities and superpower sponsors, and they were still pretty much even as late as 1973. But today, South Korea's got a higher GDP than Japan, while in North Korea, they've gone backward.
Folks, this is it. This is the timeline we have to live in.
We don't get to go home to the Grunmarkt in Timeline 1. It glows in the dark. Even if we could, would we want to? I will remind you that the only things that made the Grunmarkt tolerable were enormous local wealth and access to luxuries imported from the United States. We don't have the local wealth, and we can't import stuff from the USA anymore. We're not welcome there, in case you've forgotten. Any clan member trying to make a life in the United States risked ending up in a supermax prison for the rest of their life, or at least until their date with a federal executioner. We're stuck in Timeline 3. Stuck in the Commonwealth here, unless you think striking out at random in search of something better is a solution. At least here we've got the ear of the first man, she said, referring to the founder and head of the Radical Party, who had consolidated power in the wake of the revolution. We can work with that. But running away again isn't an option, unless our backs are up against the wall. I don't know about you, but I don't want to go and live in a cave somewhere, or a drafty castle with no antibiotics and no general anesthesia. I happen to like civilization, and this is the nearest thing we've got.
Miriam looked round at her audience. She'd taken care to ensure that half of them were women, and she could tell at a glance that she had their attention. The state of civilization in the Grunmarkt had been medieval, except where world walkers had traded in U.S. goods, such as the imported medicines that meant they didn't have to endure repeated risky pregnancies and bury half their babies before their fifth birthday. My plan, which I intend to sell to the first man, is to turn this camp into the Commonwealth's source of miracle technologies and scientific insights. We're going to engage in knowledge transfer on a historically unprecedented scale, acquiring and disseminating the necessary skills and ideas to enable the Commonwealth to play catch-up with the United States in Timeline 2. Then, once we get ourselves out of this camp and into strategic positions within their economic and industrial planning apparatus, we'll be able to move mountains. We can turn this timeline into somewhere we're proud to live, a place where we're safe from the U.S. government. And there's one more thing. Once we have official government backing for the project, we're going to skew it to suit our own agenda.
Suddenly, Helmut looked interested.
And what is that going to be as you see it?
Revolutions typically run their course in a generation. Miriam had been doing a lot of reading about revolutions. Our job is to survive this one. Things look chaotic right now, but eventually there's going to be a new normal, and I intend to get back all the stuff you're complaining about losing. Power, influence, wealth, a place in the sun.
All well and good, said Helmut. But how are you going to make our captors follow your agenda? Unless you can do that.
He sat down, clearly feeling that he'd made his point. Miriam stared at him, perplexed. What more did he want? We're going to catalyze disruptive technological development, she began, just as Iris cleared her throat. What, Mom?
The problem is political, as usual. You youngsters never make sufficient allowances for that. You especially, Helmut.
Your tool of choice is the club, not the olive branch.
Then she looked at her daughter.
I found that book of the first man's writings most interesting. If your friend Erasmus can get me anything else by Sir Adam or more reading matter of that kind, I'd be most grateful. And keep your own eyes open for useful signs in Sir Adam's writings, too. But I assure you your plan will only work if he is willing to learn from the mistakes of other revolutions and is receptive enough to contemplate a new economic policy.
Miriam frowned.
What do you mean? Isn't it obvious? You've been focusing on the idea of technological development, but you've been doing it in isolation, looking at means without considering the ends.
But I have. The ends are the development of civilization.
Sir Adam Burrows won't see it like that, Iris snapped. You are thinking like a technocrat, but Adam, the first man, is not a technocrat. He is a revolutionary. He has a vision of what should be, of a shining city on a hill, which is based, if I read him correctly, on the rights of man and woman. A vision that went out of fashion long ago in the United States. It was probably doomed by the failure of the First International, in the world you grew up in. Your late father would set you straight.
Miriam flinched. Iris had raised her in exile in Timeline 2, marrying Morris, an idealistic but ultimately ineffectual political activist. The kind of guy who had walked out of the Revolutionary Communist Party because they didn't do enough charity work, feeding the sick and clothing the poor. No, Miriam. We need to prove ourselves to Sir Adam by giving him tools that he considers useful, not what you consider important.
And what would these tools be?
Hugh asked, intrigued by the turn the conversation was taking.
Political levers, not shiny scientific toys.
Iris's eyes twinkled.
That's not to say that they cannot be the same thing, but presentation is all. Sir Adam has just led a revolution, the first successful democratic revolution in the history of this world. Forget technology for the time being. You have a crystal ball. It is your duty to bring him dismal tidings, all the myriad ways in which revolutions can come to grief. Your first job must be to produce a comprehensive report on all the failed democratic revolutions of Timeline 2, with specific analyses of how and why they failed to achieve their objectives. Show him that, and then, if you can, show him a revolution that succeeded. Show him he can learn from it and use it as an object of emulation, and he'll listen to you. In fact, if you can do that, he'll give you everything you ask for, which is how you go about setting up your paratime industrial development program. But before all else, you need to demonstrate your usefulness, and the easiest way to do that is to show him all the ways to fail that he has not imagined, so that he can avoid them.
Brilliana nodded, then grinned at Miriam. It's the oldest trick in the book, isn't it? Work out what they'll get hooked on, then give them the first hit for free. New York. Timeline 2. March 2020. Julius Horth was about to start his very last courier mission, although he didn't know it yet. There was a standardized protocol for world-walking agents entering a hostile surveillance zone. The goal was to do it quietly and anonymously, and stay one jump ahead of the surveillance cameras. He'd been doing it for more than 20 years, from his first teenage outing as a clan messenger to his current status. These days he was a major in the Commonwealth's Department of Parahistorical Research, and he was good at his job. Unfortunately, the adversaries were getting better too, and it was harder to stay ahead of the enemy every year. Julius entered Timeline 2 via a quiet side street in Brooklyn. It was lined with red brick warehouse conversions playing home to startup businesses and specialist mail-order supply shops. Few people lived here, and some of the buildings were empty, their windows boarded up as their owners waited out the slack in the business cycle. After 8 p.m., as twilight descended, a certain quiet fell. And it was then that the door of one such boarded-up building opened. An onlooker would have seen a tall, heavily built man in his late 30s or early 40s step out, glance up and down the street, and wheel a bicycle onto the sidewalk. With horn-rimmed spectacles, drainpipe jeans, plaid shirt, and knitted cardigan, he could be mistaken for a hipster. He bore a capacious messenger bag, an obscure name-brand item chosen to harmonize with the rest of his outfit. He checked carefully for cross-traffic, then locked the warehouse door and pedaled up the road, wobbling slightly. The warehouse itself was empty, seemingly abandoned when the business that had previously occupied it went bust. Only a rectangular area on the stained concrete floor marked out with duct tape would tell an informed observer that there was anything out of the ordinary about it. That, and the fact that anyone reviewing the previous day's camera footage of the front and back of the building in search of Julius's arrival would have a fruitless task. Every stage of this type of insertion was hazardous. The warehouse might have been let to a new tenant in the week since the preliminary reconnaissance designated it as an entry point, or some unfortunate event might have attracted unwanted police or DHS attention. Once one was out of the entry building, the risks continued. Unable to use a trackable phone or GPS device, Julius had memorized the neighborhood. A good solution, but only effective as long as he stuck to known territory. And he had to keep moving confidently, for he couldn't stop and consult a paper map. If his motion kinematics seemed weird, software running on the sensors embedded in the street signs on major roads would notice and call the cops. He'd then face a search for alcohol or drugs. This could not be allowed. In this world walker-aware city, there were cameras with motion-tracking firmware at every major intersection. They were designed to spot a sudden appearance out of thin air, so transfer had to be effected inside a disused building. Julius's managers back in the Commonwealth didn't think the DHS was capable of monitoring every doorway in the United States for foot traffic. Only federal buildings and security zones like airports had that level of surveillance. But sooner or later the feds would start clamping down on pedestrians and cyclists who had no radio frequency devices like phones or ID cards. It would make covert operations infinitely harder. At present, it was still possible for a courier to dip into the quiet back streets of a big city for a couple of hours without courting disaster. But the end of Commonwealth intelligence operations on U.S. soil was clearly in sight. The USA was already a harder nut for foreign infiltrators to crack than the Soviet bloc had ever been. At the end of the street, Julius stopped at the four-way and diligently checked for oncoming traffic. Most New York cyclists didn't bother. It wasn't necessary now that anti-collision radar was mandatory on cars and trucks, but he was patient. An accidental collision with another cyclist or a hot-wired car would be a mission kill at best. If it put him in the back of an ambulance, it would most likely prove fatal. He'd have to use the suicide capsule he carried in a false wisdom tooth. He pedaled on across an avenue and took a left, then wobbled slowly uphill along the main road for a block. A few streets later, he reached his destination and dismounted. He linked the bike to a railing and pretended to arm the bike lock. Then, after looking for passers-by, turned his reversible jacket inside out and put it on again. Pocketing his conspicuous glasses, he walked round the corner and straight into a cheap local diner. His contact was waiting in a seat facing the front door, toying with the wreckage of a burrito and a bottle of juice. The bottle was positioned to the left of her plate, a simple sign that meant, "I am not under duress." She was around 50, thin-faced, her black hair scraped back in a severe bun. She looked like a tired office worker. Julius paid her no obvious attention, and she gave no sign of recognition. Instead, he walked to the counter and bought tostadas and a root beer. He turned to casually survey the diner as if looking for empty seats, then carried his portion over to her table and sat down facing her.
"Good morning, Miss Milan."
She nodded politely.
"Always a pleasure to see you, Mr. Jefferson. How did the ball game go?"
"We won. 4-2.
He'd noticed no sign of surveillance on his way to the meet. The set of her shoulders relaxed infinitesimally.
"We have maybe 15 minutes. No longer. It's not safe. They're rolling out more and more networked cameras."
The safe duration for contact was narrowing all the time.
"Damn."
Her expression was pinched. Too much tension there, he thought. He'd known Paulie for years, almost since before the clan survivor's exile in the Commonwealth. She'd been a protege of Miriam herself.
"That's not good. I'm not sure I can cope if it falls below 5 minutes.
He took a mouthful of soda. As ever, it tasted oddly alien. Almost familiar, but not quite right. Too sweet. It was the high-fructose corn syrup they put in everything, he decided. It tasted weird, if you were used to cane sugar.
"You don't have to. You do a good and valuable job here, but if you think they're on to you or if it's too stressful, all you have to do is say so. We can arrange an extraction to Timeline 3 whenever you want. There's no reason for you to risk detection."
She shook her head very slightly.
"I have family. 2 nieces and a nephew who just married."
She paused.
"Also, this is my country. It's been good to my family and good to me. I can't just leave."
He put the drink down, allowed his bag to slide down to the floor by the side of the booth.
"Nevertheless, the offer remains open. She said I was to remind you that extraction is the lesser evil, compared to spending the rest of your life in a supermax prison cell for assisting supposed terrorists."
He paused.
"I don't like to be the bringer of bad news, but the risk level is becoming unacceptable. We're going to have to stop meeting like this soon. Possibly in as little as 3 months. We can work out another protocol for risk mitigation in the short term that'll keep things going a bit longer, but..."
He shrugged.
"I don't want to relocate if I can avoid it."
She twitched. Her expression was haunted.
"I know how stupid that sounds. I ought to take you up on your offer. If I was sensible, I would. I mean, you're winding down your operations over here, aren't you? But part of me keeps thinking it's about me, that I'm too old and unstable and you're just saying this to cut me loose gently."
18 million lives, he said. "That's what the antibiotic factories bought us."
The factories whose plans she'd researched and packaged for her world-walking employers years earlier.
"You asked last time, so I went and looked it up. Paulie, we're not firing you. We owe you too much."
She relaxed very slightly. "You're just flattering me now."
"There is a faraway land where you are known and honored as a hero of the revolution."
He didn't have to fake sincerity. Then force of habit prompted him to glance at his antique wind-up wristwatch.
9 minutes left.
"The shopping bag is full," she said.
A moment later, he felt something nudge against his ankle. A messenger bag identical to his own, but considerably heavier.
"I was unable to obtain a couple of the items on the list. I hope the substitutions are appropriate."
"Thank you,"
said the spy, reaching down to move her bulging bag closer to his feet.
"They almost always are. You should know that by now."
Paulette was a very experienced supplier. She knew exactly what interested Julius and his bosses. He nudged his own bag toward her. It was empty but for a block of increasingly useless $20 bills and the usual burner phone, battery physically disconnected, with a shopping list stored in its memory. When she got home, she'd turn it on and use the stored credit in it to purchase items on the list, whereupon she'd arrange for delivery to a friendly local bodega. When the job was done, she'd turn the phone off again for good, using a hammer. Once sterilized with acetone, the fragments could be safely flushed down a storm drain.
"They've discontinued the specific power supply model required for item 11. I ordered a replacement device," she said.
"Thank you."
He smiled for her and tried to put some warmth into the expression. Isolation took its toll on the sanity and sense of self-worth of the long-distance agent.
"I really mean that. What you do here is making a huge difference, more than you can imagine."
She sighed pensively, picked up her glass and drained it. "I should go now," she said.
He checked his watch. 4 minutes remaining.
"Yes, I think so."
He stood up and shouldered the messenger bag. It was far heavier than the one he'd walked in with.
"The next rendezvous is in memory. Queens, I think. I'll take the front entrance. You take the back."
"Goodbye, Julius," she said, sounding sad. "Give my best to Miriam."
"I will," he replied. "Good luck, Colonel."
He stood and left, heading toward his bicycle. The spy watched through the window for a couple of minutes until she could stand the tension no longer. Rising, she walked to the back of the diner and then through a door, the exit into the alleyway behind. The cameras overlooking the dumpsters had been carefully tagged with graffiti the week before. Blinded by paint, nobody saw her leave.
15 years of my life, for 18 million lives, she thought.
From anyone but Miriam's messenger, she wouldn't have taken it. She'd have sneered. The offer of extraction and a fresh start in a new world felt like a cynical joke. Who would she be over there? A 50-year-old spinster with no family and no life? Just a pension and a medal to wear at alien parades? A life sacrificed on the altar of an undeclared war? Whereas this was her country. It had taken in her great-grandparents. The GI Bill had put her father through college, and she'd grown up and lived her entire life here. The thought of moving away was almost unbearable. Then the claustrophobic threat of exposure, the fear of omnipresent surveillance, closed in on her once more. Sometimes it felt like a noose around her neck, threatening to strangle the breath in her throat. Sometimes she wanted to scream. "Is this all there's ever going to be for me?" Paulette wondered. "Where did it all go so wrong?" Palace of the People's Deputies, New London, Timeline 3, July, 2005. Forget musketry. Forget aviation carriers. You're going to need washing machines. Lots of washing machines. There's a saying that goes something like this. Lieutenants study tactics, colonels study strategy, generals study logistics, and field marshals study economics. But economists, the smart ones, study education. We've got 380 million people on two continents, and another 30 to 50 million overseas, and these people are the foundation on which you are building your commonwealth. Half of them are women. Of those, more than half are of working age. But they typically spend 15 hours a week slaving over washboards or banging cloth on rocks, and another 5 to 10 hours a week sewing. That's 190 million women, 100 million workers spending a third of their working time unproductively. Roll out free laundry services inside every factory gate, and you gain the equivalent of 30 million extra full-time workers. Or you can use the time not spent on drudgery to upgrade those women's education by about one high school year per 12 months. If you do that, it is an investment that pays off in the future. No productivity gain for 5 years, but then 30 million extra skilled workers become available. Or 20 million skilled workers and an army of teachers to educate the next generation. In military terms, that's enough to increase our economic base by about 20%. Enough to support 100 divisions, or a spare navy and a half, or the nuclear, corpuscular weapons program. You're going to need the working women because the United States is coming. They have aircraft that can cross between timelines. They have corpuscular petards, atomic weapons, they call them. We face a development gap of roughly 60 years. That's how far ahead of us they are, in terms of science and engineering. It's not insurmountable, but there's more to it than just better nutritional supplements and technological toys. A lot of it is psychological. They have different ways of looking at things, better cognitive models for understanding certain types of problems, and they're vastly more efficient at logistics and training than we are. Unfortunately for us, their government is frightened and angry, and they have already incinerated Timeline 1, the first other inhabited timeline they discovered. We can't afford to get this wrong. Sooner or later they will discover the Commonwealth, and they are a far deadlier threat to the revolution than the French Empire or the remnants of the old regime. If we don't deploy those extra 30 million workers, then we've lost a quarter of our workforce before we even begin. We also need to educate our people. Many of those workers could be teachers instead. We need those teachers to educate in turn the generation of skilled workers and specialists that we'll need in 20 years' time. And they will be vital to our tertiary education system, which will equip that next generation for the high technology jobs that are coming. These in turn will be generated by the series of industrial revolutions we're going to embark upon. Yes, I said industrial revolutions, plural. Technologies are not neutral. They come with attached agendas, with associated ways of thinking. Industrial revolutions are inherently political revolutions. Today's iron workers and coal miners will find it hard to adapt to tomorrow's automated factories and thinking machines. It would be very difficult for an entrenched empire to survive such a series of revolutions without experiencing serious unrest. But we, gathered here today, are the party of revolution. Our whole raison d'etre is to ride the tidal wave of change and use it to build a better future. This should not be beyond us. If we try and make a 60-year leap forward in, say, 30 years, we'll still be behind the Americans when we get there. They'll have moved another 30 years ahead of us. So what I'm proposing to do is to aim ahead of the target. Merely modernizing the new American Commonwealth on an industrial level should be achievable in 30 years, but we must also build in social structures that enable our successors to maintain the pace of progress, to make it an ongoing process. Modernization can become the engine of continuing revolution. Radical citizenship and a universal franchise are a good start, but that's not enough. We need to produce an educated, skilled workforce. And to do that, we need to deliver full female emancipation, for which family planning services are essential. Workplace nurseries are also essential. And health care and school support are both essential, too. They are also popular with women who vote. And they will vote. Next slide, please. Some of you are thinking that if we need more workers, we should simply breed them. That all that's needed is to focus our efforts on reducing childhood mortality through inoculation campaigns and the new antibiotics. But the change I'm proposing isn't just about numbers. It's about quality. I'm proposing that we engineer a demographic transition from a society with a high birth rate and a high death rate to one with a low birth rate and low death rate. Once we get there, it becomes cost-effective to train and educate everyone to a high level because we'll recoup the investment over their working life. That's one of the keys to rapid development. A transition to smaller families, much higher educational attainment, and new technologies. These factors combine to produce a generation that can work far more efficiently than their predecessors. In Timeline 2, this happened decades ago in the United States and Europe. It's happening right now in China and India. Their economies are growing at a sustained average of more than 10% a year. In 5 decades, they have gone from peasant agriculture to placing spaceships in orbit around Mars. But you can't do that with unskilled labor and a workforce that systematically excludes half the population, or with ill-educated women who are too busy and too fatigued to give their babies the attention they need to stretch their minds, teaching them to learn how to learn. Next slide, please. Communications and information technology is the next key area where the USA is notionally ahead of us. Arguably, this is the most significant area of all. Right now, we're barely aware of its existence, but it's the main engine behind the recent runaway growth in the USA, amounting to a new industrial revolution. It has also led to a number of negative problems there, including increasing structural unemployment, a ridiculously hypertrophied police state, and fiscal instability. But forewarned is forearmed, and therefore I propose that we make an end run around their worst mistakes by setting up the security frameworks for our Commonwealth's communication networks a decade before we need them. Brooklyn, New York. Timeline 2. March 2020. To get to his exfiltration site, Julius needed to take his bike on the subway for 3 stops. It was a calculated risk. His mission planners had decided it was faster and marginally less dangerous than requiring him to ride for 15 blocks through Brooklyn. And if the weather was inclement, it was clearly preferable. But this was where he ran into trouble. To get to the subway station, he pedaled uphill along a couple of residential streets, then turned onto a main street. It was an uneventful, if effortful, ride. He was in good shape for his age, but the way the Americans had taken to neglecting their road surfaces was shameful, and by the end of the trip he was glad for the front and rear shocks on the mountain bike. Every second he spent in Timeline 2 gave him a crawling gunsight sensation between his shoulder blades, as if one of the Americans' invisible flying killer robots was stalking him across the streets of the city. While his path took him past no fewer than 19 CCTV cameras, most of these were domestic or commercial alarm systems. Only one was connected to the municipal surveillance system, and that via the Department of Transport automatic number plate lookup system. Even in the United States, bicycles were not yet expected to bear plates. But the entrance to the subway station took Julius down a flight of drab concrete steps into an underground vestibule with ticket machines and barriers. And here things changed. The city of New York had become extremely sensitive to terrorist threats since the turn of the 21st century, and the subway was seen as a primary target. Not only that, it was a highly efficient checkpoint. After all, almost everybody used it. Entering the station, Julius passed under the lenses of cameras on the staircase, of cameras fronting the ticket machines, of cameras watching the faces of everybody passing through the barriers, and finally, of the cameras on the platform and on the subway train itself. These cameras had just enough onboard intelligence to match faces against a database of persons of interest, and to call for help if they scored a hit. And, all unbeknownst to him, Julius had become a person of interest. It wasn't because he had been detected making contact with Paulette Milan on a previous visit. Julius's tradecraft was watertight, his organization's doctrine as good as any. It wasn't because he'd been observed behaving oddly. It was simply that bigger memory cards made it practical to store more faces on each camera node. And in addition to the FBI's most wanted, the cameras now looked for a wide range of interesting people. Julius was a person of interest because he'd been observed on numerous previous occasions, and never identified. His face was known, his biometrics logged, but he was never associated with the same cell phone ID, or with RFID tags in an ID card, or the washing instruction labels in his clothing, or even with the same bicycle. Julius was a blind spot in the surveillance network's purview, like the 600-mile-per-hour moving hole in the radar reflection of a rain cloud that betrays the passage of a stealth bomber. And as he walked toward the back of the platform for a train to Forest Hills, phones began to buzz. As it happened, Julius didn't have to cool his heels for long. After just 4 minutes, a 7 train screeched and rattled its way to a halt beside the platform, and he rolled his bike aboard. The organization had run couriers through the city before, equipped with carefully configured sensors, programmed to record the distribution of monitoring cameras. They carried Wi-Fi receivers in promiscuous mode, sniffing for buried Ubicomp cells. They also used jailbroken phones with baseband chips, hacked to help them map cell towers. The results were alarming. In the past 3 years, the density of surveillance devices scattered through New York City had skyrocketed tenfold, and there was no sign that this increase would slow down until every square meter of sidewalk and road had its own secret police machine, vigilant for signs of subversion. What the organization hadn't done was to run the same tests on subway trains. 40th Street, Queens Boulevard. 3 stations ahead, 4 transit police stopped what they were doing and paused, listening to their earpieces. Walking, not running, there was plenty of time. They began to converge on the nearest eastbound platform. 2 other cops, busy with a random search, declined the call. 46th Street Station. Julius had over many years developed an almost supernatural sensitivity to the signs and portents of operations on hostile soil. Right now he wasn't on full alert, but he was never entirely relaxed when on a mission, and some instinct he couldn't name made him tense up and glance surreptitiously up and down the almost deserted subway car. Too long, he thought, his skin crawling. The train sat at the platform edge, brakes ticking, transformer fans humming. Something's wrong. 10 seconds stretched into 20, then 30. Uh-oh. It might just be a signaling fault, he told himself. That's probably all it is. But the MTA had in-cab signaling these days, didn't it? They'd just completed a monstrously expensive upgrade to the entire network. Julius took a lurching step to one side, just as the doors hissed and rattled closed. Cold sweat burst out up and down his spine. The train began to move. He looked around quickly. Reasons for delaying a train. 1, signal at red. 2, mechanical fault. 3, allowing someone to get into position ahead. Scheiße. Time to bail. Maybe he was spooking at shadows, but instinct told him otherwise. He unslung his messenger bag and slid the jacket off his shoulders. Inverted it again, other way out. Pulled the spectacles out of their pouch and put them on before he picked up the messenger. A quick glance at the bike. Farewell, trusty steed. The train was already slowing. Nobody had looked up. Nobody was watching him. He glanced at the ceiling, seeing the cluster of pinhead-sized camera pickups. Ops had assumed they were offline recorders, just logging foot traffic and faces for digestion at the end of the day. But what if that monstrously expensive network upgrade had been enough to carry live video streams of all the cameras on all the trains? A decade ago it would have been preposterous, but these days? Julius turned and ran to the other end of the car. 52nd Street Station. The train rattled and squealed to a stop. Doors banged open up and down its length. 2 MTA transit cops entered the rear carriage, scanned the seated passengers with practiced eyes. A bicycle shackled to a vertical rail told its story. One of them swore under his breath as the doors closed again. As the train began to move, the door at the end of the carriage, the one giving passage to the next car along, squealed and banged open, admitting a rattle of tracks and a gust of stale subway air. Julius was already stepping onto the platform when the transit cops got on the carriage behind the one he was leaving. He kept his eyes down, shoulders hunched. Two more cops waited by the turnstile, heads cocked slightly to one side, listening to their earpieces as they waited for the handful of passengers to leave the platform.
Fuck, it's a sweep.
Mouth dry and heart pounding, Julius walked toward the barriers. Two on the train at the back to push forward, two on the gates to stop anyone from escaping. It'd be the same ahead, all the way to the end of the line. Subway trains were beautiful things right up until they turned into a killing ground. He mentally rehearsed what he'd have to do, but kept his hands free. Pepper spray in one pocket. Drop knife concealed under the cuff of his right wrist.
I don't want to do this, he realized distantly.
They were just transit cops, doing a dirty and unrewarding job. The turnstile buzzed. He walked through. An incurious glance, and they were behind him. Sometimes the oldest tricks are the best. They'd be looking for a man with a bicycle in a green jacket, and here was a guy in spectacles and a blue jacket, no bike. Still. He tensed and lengthened his stride. If the trains are networked, then any moment now they'll hear that the mobile team found the bike. Escalator. Legs pumping, Julius bounded up, shoving his way past an older man with a walking stick, a woman wearing earbuds. The cry came later than he expected.
Hey, you! Stop! Police!
Julius ran. They were near the bottom of the escalator, but he was almost at the top. There was more shouting, he didn't stop to listen. Then he saw the emergency stop button, punched it in passing, and a bright pain shot up his left hand. An alarm bell began to clang behind him, and he heard a loud, mechanical, grating noise, accompanied by indignant yelling. People falling down, good, under the circumstances. He made it into the daylight, breathing hard, and kept running. The surveyed return point was an alleyway that ran between a foreclosed house and a shuttered head shop, just around the block from the station. Julius took the corner at a run, certain the cops were on his heels. They might be holding fire because of bystanders, but that was no guarantee of safety against New York's finest. There was no time to check for witnesses. He was going to burn this site. Julius ran to the spot beside the fire escape they'd surveyed on a previous mission, pulled on the electric strap of his wristwatch, and flipped the device upside down so that the crystal lay against his wrist and the back was visible. Engraved into the burnished metal of the casing was an interlocking knotwork of tail-chasing complexity. He focused on clearing his mind and stared at the pattern that would take him back to Timeline 1, just as the first officer rounded the corner, gun in hand, and opened fire.
Hiatus.
Fort George, New York, Timeline 3, March 2020. It took two world-walking jumps in quick succession to return to the Commonwealth from Timeline 2. Normally Julius would take his time to recover between trips, find a fallen tree or something to sit on, but he was spooked and took the second jump too fast. Pain spiked through his forehead as he dropped the messenger bag and bent forward, retching, his ears still ringing with the echo of the single gunshot. He stood in the center of a large room, high-ceilinged and with whitewashed walls, his knees wobbling like jelly.
That was much too close, he thought numbly.
Painted markings on the floor corresponded to the layout of the alleyway. Helpful hands took the messenger bag, while others eased a wheelchair into place behind him.
Easy there, Major. Please sit down. Thanks,
he tried to say, tongue-tied. That was a really bad mission exit, he thought. Just about the second worst outcome possible. I'm getting too old for this shit. In his late 30s, he was old for an agent, especially a world-walking agent running courier missions into a hostile high-tech surveillance state. The idea of shuffling quietly into a desk job and then a slow slide down to retirement usually lacked appeal. But right now, he was experiencing a dizzying perspective shift. Retirement was a welcome prospect, compared with the alternative so recently on offer. Medic! Medic! He settled into the chair as someone slipped a blood pressure cuff around his left arm and began to inflate it. Home again, he thought.
Blood pressure's 165 over 116, sir. If you lie back, we'll get that down. This won't hurt.
Julius relaxed, feeling the familiar sting of a needle seeking a vein in his left forearm. Over to the left, the forensics and biologicals teams were taking inventory of the courier bag, checking for unwanted passengers. Everyone wore surgical masks and overalls. Access to the quarantine arrival room was via an operating theater-grade scrub and robing area. Nobody wanted to risk importing plagues or parasites from a parallel universe. The doctor and paramedics crowded around his chair, wanting to slip their latest potion into his bloodstream, a cocktail of potassium-sparing diuretics and a fancy new calcium channel blocker, guaranteed to smack down post-world-walking hypertension within minutes. It was far better than the old prescriptions the clan's doctors had fumbled together, back before they had a superpower's entire pharmaceutical industry to call on. His arrival and reception had been recorded by the bulky cameras in the corners of the room, while technicians logged everything on the crude, locally made computer terminals lined up against the far wall. The Department of Parahistorical Research was meticulous about data collection on these runs. Missions to the United States of America were extremely hazardous. Nobody could guess in advance what might be of interest to the Board of Inquiry if a world walker was lost.
Open wide, sir?
Julius gaped for the dentist's forceps. A sharp tug, and the man held up the false crown for inspection.
All clear.
He transferred the crown to a labeled jar.
I'd like to book you in for descaling and a regular check. There's a bit of plaque developing. Otherwise, you can go whenever Brian is through with you.
I want to take another blood reading in 5 minutes.
Brian, the doctor with the sphygmo manometer and the antihypertensives, was taciturn.
I'll sign you off for decontamination when it's back within sight of normal, but not a moment sooner.
More than your job's worth, eh?
Julius asked, joking. But judging from the medic's frown, it was no joking matter.
If I let you go early and you suffer an apoplectic fit, it wouldn't just be my job that's on the line. With the flu doing the rounds, we've got only 84 walkers available for active ops this week.
80.
He swallowed a curse. Of course. Plagues could travel piggyback on a world walker in either direction, and importing a nasty epidemic wasn't the only risk the Department of Parahistorical Research ran when it authorized a transfer mission. The other timeline was terrifyingly proficient at automated genome scanning and biowarfare defense. If a flu strain from the Commonwealth ever got loose over there, the U.S. authorities would rapidly deduce the existence of the DPR's espionage program. Pinpointing exactly where Patient Zero had arrived would follow, and then the consequences would be bad. Starting with the enemy waking up and plastering Manhattan Island in Timeline 1 with sensors and killer drones, then going rapidly downhill from there. Julius waited while the medics fussed, trying to relax. As usual, it did little to speed things up. After a couple of inconclusive blood pressure checks and then a better one,
Brian grudgingly pronounced himself satisfied, and an unseen attendant wheeled Julius into the robing area. He stripped, showered, and dressed himself in civilian clothes, every step following strict decontamination protocols. It was a soothing and familiar ritual. He'd performed it more than 1,000 times in the 16 years since he'd joined the Department of Parahistorical Research, and in rudimentary form for years before that. It was far more elaborate and effective than anything the clan had bothered with back in the old days, more like the routine his bright younger brother Hugh had come up with for probing new timelines. But the DPR didn't dance to the same tune as the fractious families of merchant princes who had made their homes in the Grunmarkt. Far from it. The guards in the lobby of the building saluted politely enough, but kept a close eye on him.
"Sign here, Citizen Major," said the sergeant waiting by the turnstile with a clipboard.
Julius nodded, signed.
"Thank you," the sergeant continued. "You may leave the secure zone now."
He gave no sign of recognition, even though he'd been on this posting for several months, and had spoken exactly the same words to Julius at least 30 times. Inter-service rivalry could be brutal in the post-revolutionary Commonwealth, and the troops were drawn from the Commonwealth Guard, a body loyal to the party, rather than the state. Outside the squat concrete shed, Julius paused for a minute to take in the evening air. Then he headed toward the office block where he would make his report in person. Fort George was still centered on a century-old shingle-roofed brick barracks, but it had lately been overrun by an infestation of concrete. There was fresh cement everywhere from the driveways to the new multi-story office buildings, including the sinister hemispheres facing out toward the Atlantic coast, their embrasures concealing anti-aircraft missile launchers. About the only new structures that weren't made of the stuff were the radar dishes and the flagpole. The 21st century was definitely the age of concrete, Julius mused. Concrete and blast doors and automobiles with floor-mounted gear shifts. Sidewalks and orange-glaring streetlights that turned the night to day, the gold to chrome. It was all horribly industrial, as far from nature as one could get. Computer terminals with cord keyboards and green phosphor screens and magnetic cartridge drives. Sometimes it seemed as if the Commonwealth was desperate to turn itself into an echo of the paranoid place he had just visited. A growing shriek, like the howl of a demented, mindless god, split the sky overhead. Julius glanced up in time to see a pair of silvery arrowheads disappearing into the eastern sky, trailing orange fire. A few seconds later, double thunderclaps rattled the windows. They were probably off to protect the Commonwealth's airspace from encroaching French bombers. A job at which they were very good, although it was anybody's guess how effective such second-generation fighter jets would be if they were called upon to defend the homeland against the stealth drones and advanced electronics of the United States. Cambridge, Massachusetts. Timeline 3. Spring, 2018. Another day, another public opening ceremony. The Commonwealth public loved factory opening ceremonies. Opening ceremonies meant jobs, money, and the white heat of a new technological revolution. Drama, television cameras, a news autogyro circling overhead to get the best shots of a vast new complex. They'd be highlighting the shiny new parking lots and monorail stations, linking the factory to the planned workers' satellite towns. "I just wish I could hire an actor to stand in for me," Miriam thought wearily as she adjusted her white gloves. Erica, her makeup assistant, fussed around her hair, making sure every strand was in place. "I want to mat your forehead some more, madame," she said. "Otherwise the cameras will..." "Certainly."
Miriam sat still. Her legs ached, her back ached. Sometimes it felt like she was a single ache, held together by willpower. She was a year off 50, and middle age was not proving to be fun, even without the cancer scare the other year. As long as you're done in 10 minutes. Don't worry, Minister. That was Jeffrey, her young new PA. Was it just her, or were PAs getting younger every year and changing faster and faster? Hell, Radical Party commissioners seemed to be getting younger by the day, too, especially since she'd ended up running a ministry of her own, the then unforeseen but retrospectively inevitable outcome of that prison camp meeting all those years ago. You're looking wonderful, madame. Great. She kept her face still as Erica dusted her, brushes flicking. Fashions had changed slowly in the new British Empire of old, at least until relatively recently. Fabric and labor had been more expensive than in the United States, so clothing had to be made to last. The revolution that had overturned the old monarchy and created the new American Commonwealth had done away with the Baroque court dress of the old royal court, for which Miriam was sincerely grateful. But the outfits she was expected to wear, as a female minister presiding over public events, were still elaborate compared with what she'd grown up with. It meant her entourage was large. Dressers and makeup artists, as well as bodyguards and personal assistants. Do we have time for one last run-through? Half an hour later, she was on stage, standing before a bouquet of bulbous microphones and a flicker of press camera flashes. Beside her were the Mayor of Cambridge, the Citizen Commissioner of Development for the Republic of Massachusetts, and a collection of local party members and hand-picked workers. Then it was time for speechifying. Today is a great day for Cambridge and Massachusetts, and more important, for the entire Commonwealth. The Commonwealth has made great progress in the past 15 years, but many of our fellow citizens have yet to be exposed to the revolutionary potential of microelectronics, much less the potential of automation, information technology, and computing that the microprocessor makes possible. Before she'd discovered, or been discovered by, the Klan and learned to world walk, Miriam had grown up in the United States. She'd worked as a tech journalist during the dot-com boom era. The hackneyed Silicon Valley rhetoric of revolutionary change came easily to her. But to ears raised in the new American Commonwealth, it sounded fresh, exciting, and new. They'd barely had vacuum tubes when she arrived. This factory will showcase the Watertown Semiconductor Cooperative's first fully integrated fab line, a historic breakthrough. And one day in the future, we'll be able to put a mini computer in every school and workplace across the Commonwealth, not to mention eventually providing the brains for the secure terminals required by the People's Logistic Allocation Network in every factory and warehouse and farm across three continents. Training our children for the computerized future they will live in. Keep it as short as possible, was one of her guidelines. Miriam had sat through too many of these events, on the other side of the mics and cameras, to enjoy abusing her captive audience. But make it too short, and nobody will notice anything you say. And Miriam needed to milk every opportunity to be heard. It wasn't just everyday politics. It was vitally important to keep the master plan visible in the public eye at all times, gathering momentum, delivering the goods. Or in this case, delivering the first indigenous crude 8-bit microprocessors from the Commonwealth's first civilian semiconductor factory. All because the USA was coming. Finally, it was time for the ribbon cutting and confetti, the latter an imported prop, one that had been latched onto with enthusiasm by the locals, and the band struck up a jaunty revolutionary march. Miriam took her place at the end of the receiving line in the factory canteen, beside the union convener and the plant's magistrate. They were both old hands, deeply wary of each other and of her world-walking self. They clearly had no intention of burying their worker management hatchet without some discreet external head-banging. "Play nicely now," she said, smiling at the magistrate over a glass of passable sparkling Zinfandel. "We're in this to make life better for everyone, not just a select few."
"In my experience, the nobs don't settle for just their share of the cake if they think they can have it all," said the union rep.
"You've got my office number. If you think the managers are overreaching, I assure you my staff will be very interested to hear about it. Just try to remember that my task is to ensure the best outcome for the nation as a whole." She smiled again to take some of the sting out of the words. "This plant isn't going to stand still and hammer out the same products for the next 30 years, you know. Today's chips will be obsolete in 5 years' time. The only constant will be change." The line shuffled forward while she shook hands, chatted over her shoulder, and exchanged smiles and the odd greeting with the people before her. They were into the workers now, mostly skilled technical personnel who'd been taken on to run the silicon foundry. She was glad she was wearing gloves. About 1 in 4 of them seemed to want to cripple her with their robust handshakes, but at least she wouldn't need to worry about picking up the flu. A young man stood before her, wide-eyed. Something about him didn't seem quite right. It wasn't his clothing, a regular worker's suit with a cravat after the modern style, or hair, curly, with flyaway locks, escaping the grip of his pomade, but rather his curiously fixed expression. Somehow it reminded her of someone she'd seen before. "Hello," she said, smiling professionally, and reaching out to take his right hand. "How are you today?"
"Danger!"
As he opened his mouth, she remembered where she'd seen that look. Back during the revolution, or even earlier. He snatched his hand back from her offered palm, lips curling back in rage.
"Down!"
It was Melvin, her number one bodyguard, shouting over the hubbub. Miriam ducked without thinking and began to roll, realizing, "This is going to hurt tomorrow." Then somebody landed on top of her, crushing the breath from her body and shoving her off to the side as the young man shouted, "For God and Emperor!" and repeatedly pulled the trigger of the snub-nosed revolver he had somehow improbably smuggled in past the security guards. Someone shrieked hoarsely in an uncontrolled, bloody-throated wail of pain. The crash of the gun so close felt like ice picks in her inner ears. A bullet struck the floor close enough to her face that she saw splinters. More screaming and a bellow of rage.
"God and—"
boots stomping past her face. Different screams, with the shrieking of whoever had been shot, a ghastly counterpoint.
"Got him!"
Miriam gasped, trying to breathe. Her ribs hurt, and her left shoulder was a solid lump of agony. For a moment she wondered if she'd been shot too, but there was no blood.
"Off me," she tried to wheeze.
A second later, the man lying atop her shifted, grinding her harder against the floor, then began to lever himself up.
"Sorry, ma'am. Clear?"
The latter question was not addressed to her.
"Shoot her down, stand down, stand down. Evacuate the minister."
Suddenly she was free. Miriam took a deep, moaning breath and began to push herself up on her right elbow. Strong hands grabbed her under the armpits and bodies closed in, carrying her backstage in a rush. Her chest heaved.
"I'm all right," she choked out. "Let me walk."
Melvin was insistent.
"Madame, we have to get you out of—"
"I'll walk." Her chest heaved.
"How many gunmen?"
"Just the one, but—"
"Casualties?"
She dug her heels in, turning to face him. Her bodyguards drew in, facing outward, forming a human shield. "Who's hurt?"
"Madame,
He hit Jeffrey in the stomach. An ambulance will be here just as soon as...
Who else?
His shots went wide, thank God, said the other guard.
Right.
She took a deep breath, then another, assessing the situation. Lone gunman, one pistol, one injured, nobody killed. Secure the scene, Mel, I'm going back.
Ma'am, I can't let you...
You can't stop me, and you mustn't stop me, she shot right back. Do you want to make me look like a coward? There are frightened people there,
but Commissioner, fuck it!
Miriam took an unsteady half-step forward. Her guards shuffled around uneasily, more shocked by her language than by the assassination attempt.
Do you want to make me look like a coward?
She glared at her escort.
Because if I hide, that's what I'll be.
She drew herself fully upright, winced and gritted her teeth, forcing herself to ignore her shoulder.
I've a factory to open, and we're not going to let some little royalist toe rag spoil the big day for everybody else. If he'd brought backup, that'd be another matter, but...
She took another step, and they made way for her as she walked back toward the auditorium, which was in turmoil. The shrieking was subsiding, but the sound of sirens was still rising outside. Press flashbulbs flared.
I'm going back in there, and I'm going to call for calm.
She bared her teeth at Melvin.
Because that's my job. Otherwise, the terrorists have won. And that's not going to happen on my watch.